My time is short. I have no sons. I need a man to assume my position when I am gone.
Then it was a test? But why me?
Because you are most worthy. That is now proven beyond any doubt. And because my precious daughter loves you.
Forget it.
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of FW Presents, the anthology show of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Today, we are celebrating the passing of another beloved comic book writer, the second in a short span of time. Denny O'Neill passed away about a week ago. And for this episode, I am joined by my fellow co-hosts, Rob Kelly.
Howdy.
Ryan Daly.
Hello.
Chris Franklin.
Salutations.
And I am the irredeemable Shag. So it kind of sucks that we've gotten together for unpleasant situations like this recently. But I guess the upside is it's given us a chance to reexamine some great works. I mean, Denny O'Neill has been an incredibly influential writer and editor over the years. And a lot, it's really touched on a lot of stuff for us. Like, you know, Ryan and Chris both. I mean, I'll throw it to both of you guys. I mean, obviously, he's sort of the shepherd of Batman for a long time. I mean, Ryan, didn't you come in during his era as an editor?
I did, actually, yeah. That was for the most part, when I started getting into comics, and Batman was one of my gateway drugs into reading comics, it was during his time as editor. And I would actually say more than that, after Frank Miller, Denny O'Neill was one of the first names that I really thought of and associated with. I mean, when I was getting into comics, I didn't know the people behind the works that much, with a few exceptions, because I knew Frank Miller because I knew that the same guy wrote Year One and The Dark Knight Returns, and I read those at a way too early formative age. but then, I got the trade paperback for Venom, which was a series within Legends of the Dark Knight. Wow, this is a story that's actually about something, and this is somebody who has something to say. So I knew who he was as the writer, and then I understood that he was kind of the editor and understood this. And then going back through the history, I knew that he had been writing Batman in the 70s and kind of revolutionized the character and took him to this place after the very sort of what they call campy, kiddie television series, that Denny O'Neill brought him to this place that was darker, more mysterious, more supernatural, and a bit more pulp inspired. I knew who he was, and I've just always had that appreciation for him. And then just, you know, going through as my expansion of comic knowledge and awareness and readership grew, he was just always there because he was connected to so many books and characters that I liked. So yeah, he's always been there, and he was there from the beginning.
Well, similarly, Chris, I mean, he wrote some episodes of Batman the Animated Series. I've heard you constantly make references to the revamp of the Joker in the 70s when he made him edgier again. I mean, where was your first touchstone with Denny?
I guess, we recently talked about some Denny O'Neill Batman stories on Nightcast and in our crossover with the Overlooked Dark Knight podcast with Michael and Andy. And I had a Tempo paperback that reprinted two O'Neill and Adams Batman stories and then two, like, Sheldon Moldoff-drawn stories. You talk about a night and day experience. I mean, even at age, at age, like, four, I looked, it's like, are two of these stories from another planet? I mean, what, that's the first time then I didn't know who Denny O'Neill was. But by the time he came back as editor, I had read some of those, I had read those books and, I had went back and I'd seen reprints of them, the stories elsewhere. But yeah, I knew Denny O'Neill was the guy that introduced the Grim Avenger of the Night Batman, took him back to his roots. So it was real exciting to have him, be the shepherd of the comics. And at the same time, that was around the time that I was getting access to a comic shop. So I was able to go and buy, like, the original issues, that he had written. And I mean, it was kind of a crapshoot, when you were, you'd see a Neil Adams cover and, you might get, and this is nothing against Irv Novik, I like Irv Novik, but you thought you were going to get Neil Adams, you get Irv Novik. And then, you didn't get Irv Novik, you got Bob Brown. But, you've got a pretty good chance of getting a Denny O'Neill. So you're like, hey, it's good. I got a Denny O'Neill story, right? And so, it was just, when you got a Denny O'Neill Batman story, it was a, you knew you were in good hands. I mean, even as a, 12-year-old kid, I'm like, okay, this is the goods. This is the stuff. And I mean, Denny O'Neill is me and Ryan said it last time. I mean, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams are almost as important to Batman as Bob Kane and Bill Finger. You know, I mean, it's just in Batman alone. So, and that's even not even half of his contributions to comics.
And obviously, Chris, you know, and Ryan with their connection to Batman, I've got a connection I'll talk about in a minute. But probably the most direct connection to any of us is with you, Rob. I mean, he helped name Optimus Prime. So
definitely, that's what I had in my notes as his number one contribution to comics was that. Chris and Ryan, they just talked about that. They covered Denny O'Neill stories with Mike and Andrew over their crossovers, and they're specifically talking about the Joker's five-way revenge, which is, you know, one of the great Batman stories of all time. And I will tell you, it's a fun fact about that comic book. That comic has never been covered on a podcast in the last 24 hours. But no, I'm sorry. The guy's contribution to comics is so massive, and kind of going back to what I said when we assembled for the Martin Pasco Memorial Show is that, like I mentioned, that comic writers, when I was growing up, it only seemed like comics, all of comics were written by like 12 guys. Like that was about it. And Denny O'Neill was one of those guys. And he was unique because I knew what he looked like thanks to that page that some DC Comics ran in the late 60s where, like, they won some awards. And it was like there were drawings of Denny and Neil and, like, Dick Giordano with his cool 60s mustache and, like, Bob Oxner. And it was like, oh, that's what Denny – like, it made me realize these are real guys. That's what Denny O'Neill looks like. And even though, of course, over the intervening decades, he changed his look, as we all do, but in my mind, that's what Denny O'Neill always looked like, was that drawing by Neil Adams. So it's like, that's the guy, that's Denny O'Neill. But I mean, yeah, he's just one of his, if you go through his credits on Mike's Amazing World, it's all over the place, all different companies. It's just it's a huge, massive career in this industry. And it's remarkable.
You know, first time I ever noticed Denny was, and this is the same touch point for me where his big influence on me initially was, he was the editor on Firestorm for all those tumultuous years where they changed to the Russian version and the Elemental version, all that. Denny was the editor and all that. And he always had a column in the back called From the Den. And it had a little caricature of him, Rob. So to me, that's what Denny O'Neill looked like, was this little caricature, if you've ever seen it. And the first time I ever remember, like, noticing him as a human being, as an individual, was one of his From the Den columns told this great story about how he was on a plane ride and he was editing a Batman comic or had a Batman comic of some sort. And the person next to him, and this is in 1989, was astounded that Batman was still being published. As far as they knew, Batman was just a TV character from the 60s. They had no idea that Batman had a life outside of the Adam West TV series. And so he had to explain to this person all this stuff and about the upcoming movie. And so it was a backdoor pitch to say, hey, the movie's coming kind of thing. But it always stuck with me that there's people out there in the world, at least as of 1989, that didn't even realize comic book characters were a thing, that they were just TV icons to them. So I always found that interesting.
Just think, thanks to that plane ride, that guy started his Batman phase.
That is absolutely true. So the Firestorm thing for me is probably the big, and I'll talk a little more about it, I guess, when we get to our stories. But yeah, the Firestorm thing is probably where I feel like I had the biggest overlap. So even though I did go through a big Batman phase, and Denny was the editor through all of it, and I've read tons of Denny comics, it surprises me as an editor how he shepherded people. I'll tell this story real quick. Why not? So he edited Daredevil for a long time. In fact, he's the one who put Frank Miller in the job of writing the book. Now, he had already been drawing the book, but he gave Frank a chance at writing a backup story, and he thought, well, you know, if Frank sucks, he can rewrite it himself, meaning Denny can rewrite it himself. And Frank did a great job. And in this interview he did with a website called The Man Without Fear, they asked him about working with Frank Miller and Klaus Janson and what was it like, and, you know, how what was the back and forth. And this is what really impressed me. This is a great sign as an editor. Denny says, we talked a lot, meaning him and Frank Miller and Klaus Janson, sometimes two or three times a week. I suggested, urged, pointed, and amplified, but the book was theirs, not mine. My job was just to help them realize their vision. Which, I mean, wow. I mean, that's certainly not what an editor is nowadays. They're either a yes man or they're, you know, a micromanager. So it's really interesting to hear his perspective on that. And then I think back to Firestorm, because John Ostrander came in with all these ideas on how he wanted to completely revamp the book. And Denny's like, hell yeah, let's do it. and he just helped John, you know, mold it the best way possible. So that story really sticks out with me.
That's what a good editor is supposed to do. You know, they're not supposed to control the book. They're supposed to guide the people that he hired to do the book, or he or she hired to do the book.
And he said also in another interview, I can't remember where, but he mentioned that back when he was editing books in like the 70s and 80s, like the sales figures for certain books weren't shared with the editors very often. So they didn't make editorial decisions based on what they thought. Like, he didn't force tie-ins or crossovers or things like that just to get sales bumps for things. He let the story go where it should have gone organically at the time.
Yeah. You hear a lot of apocryphal stories too, where they say the editor's responding to all the letters that came in. You're right, not sales figures. I'm sorry, Chris, you were going to say something.
No, I was going to say his method for editing like that probably came a lot from Dick Giordano, who was his editor at Charlton. That. Yeah, because he was Denny's editor at Charlton, and Denny was one of the guys that Dick brought with him when he got the job at DC, and he brought Jim Aparo, and he brought Ditko over with him. He brought Denny O'Neill, and you know, that kind of hands off approach to let your talent do their thing is definitely you know, Giordano's thing as well. And he paid it forward with a whole nother crop of creators.
And all of that happened because he got fired from Marvel for clashing with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. Like, I mean, we're going to talk about some of the stories that he did, but Denny was, I don't know if you could almost call him like an original social justice warrior in terms of he was always putting issues like this in the forefront of his books. He brought race to his books. He brought drug awareness to the books. He brought issues of poverty and urban crime and pollution and all these other issues that really weren't being discussed. I mean, he encapsulated it all in like the Hard Traveling Heroes, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow book, which we'll talk about. But it wasn't limited to that. He brought those to his other, you know, books, like when he was doing. And he has told the story before. I mean, he was a journalist working in a small, really conservative town in Missouri, and that Denny's pretty far left, and he was clashing with everybody there. That his bosses hated him, but they knew that he could write, so they kept him on for a little while. But it was when I think Martin Luther King Jr. was like making the rounds doing speeches. Denny like went to a police station and put up some kind of like blotter, like announcement or something on the wall of the police station that, you know, Dr. King would be coming through the town or something to like give a speech or whatever. And it was all made up. He admits that he falsified the story just to see if he could provoke a reaction. And it backfired big time because like he was called by his boss. He's like, I don't know if you're responsible for this, but if you did, never tell anyone or you will be killed. Like, he was like, wow. You will be lynched. And basically, that happened in the same weekend. Roy Thomas was like, hey, I read this, like, audition piece you wrote for, like, the Marvel Comics. Why don't you give me, why don't you stop by New York sometime and, like, talk to me? And Denny's like, funny you should mention that. I think I need to get out of this town really quick.
Wow.
And he moved out. And he had a wife who was pregnant who also, I think just based on the state of things, like, his wife couldn't get a job. She couldn't drive a car. And she couldn't type, so her prospects were very limited. So Denny was just kind of desperate. And he's like, "Yeah, I'll take this job writing comics," which wasn't something that he thought anybody would aspire to do because it wasn't a career that most people would think of. But he did it sort of out of desperation, and it turned into this thing. And then, yeah, he was working for Marvel for a time, and Stan Lee, who was also, you know, he would get on Stan's soapbox and preach his vows, but Stan Lee thought Denny was way too liberal, way too like leftist, wearing I don't know if it was like getting out of Vietnam pins or something like that. The way he dressed, he just thought it was inappropriate for the office. He thought it was like, I don't know if it was like a cut your hair or something like that. But it was basically like Denny O'Neill had this clash with Stan Lee in the office. And Stan was like, I don't like this guy's style. And Denny went to Jack Kirby and he's like, can you believe this? He's like, why is he giving me shit for like the way I dress, you know, like wearing like a t-shirt? He's like, why do we have to dress up like, you know, wear like suit and ties? And thinking that Jack Kirby would stand up for him. And Jack Kirby's like, hey, we're in Madison Avenue. You wear a goddamn tie to work. And so like after that, Denny's like, he's like, okay, my days at Marvel are numbered. And that's why he ended up going to I don't know if it was Charlton or DC first, but what led him to go there in the 70s.
Yeah, you know, Neil Adams had a little remembrance of Denny that Dan Greenfield put on 13th Dimension, which is really great. You should all should read that. And he actually mentioned how, you know, Denny came him coming from journalism. He brought a reality, a grounded nature to his stories. I mean, they weren't just relevant. There was a grit and a reality to them. I mean, nothing against what Stan, you know, like you said, Stan had relevant stories as well, but there was something about Denny's that just rang more true because he had written like real world articles, stories, journalism about these things, and he, you know, implanted them into these fantastical stories, and that was a mix that, you know, nobody had really tried before, you know, with superhero comics. So and of course everybody goes to Green Lantern, Green Arrow. That's true. You know, it is the standard for that. But I mean, Denny was a guy that said, hey, you can like go to this level of realism and then still have guys flying around and, you know, with a magic green ring, you know, basically. And he proved that it worked, and it didn't hurt that Neil Adams was drawing it too, you know, just to sell the realism and the fantasy.
He had the man on the street type of voice within his books, like the dialogue, the captions and everything like that. Like a Stan Lee script might have felt like it was being narrated by Watu the Watcher or something like that. Whereas, you know, Denny's scripts felt like it was he put you in there. He put you in the head of the characters more often than not. And there was he made the characters grounded to that, to the extent that I think he would be the first person to admit he struggled writing the bigger, more cosmic characters. I mean, one of his first gigs at DC at the same time as Green Lantern was Wonder Woman. And what did he do with Wonder Woman? He depowered her. He made her a Diana Rigg, like, Special Agent I Ching martial arts fighter for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then go figure that he also got Justice League of America. And my gateway for that one as Ed Hur character for 20 years, which not the happiest about that, but it made her a present figure, which she hadn't been for that decade before that.
Well, conceptually, there wasn't. I don't think there's a lot wrong with Green Arrow and Black Canary together. It's just a lot of the execution over the years, which it gets very problematic. Rob, did you want to read one of these nice quotes Bill Sienkiewicz put together?
Yeah, there was a very nice quote from Bill Sienkiewicz who said, "The great Denny O'Neill has passed away late last night, quietly, peacefully at home, with his home healthcare nurse holding his hand. He was a kind man with an acerbic edge, a giving soul, wickedly funny, and an incredibly talented writer who penned some of the greatest comic stories ever told. He was also my first editor on Moon Knight, which, as a fan of his work, made me up my game. More, he took time out of work life to become a friend, one who generously gave of his personal time to talk from experience and of demons to a young farm kid from New Jersey about the path of self-destruction this farm kid was heading down because of a farm kid's drinking. Not many folks will step up like that. Denny did, and I will be forever grateful. He helped make me a better professional and a better artist and storyteller, a better person, and to take what I do very seriously as a responsibility. Of course, in doing so, he also helped create a monster who butted heads with him about any number of creative issues on Moon Knight. But in the end, he was a dear friend, a wonderful colleague and mentor. I learned so very much from him. You will be missed, my friend. Rest in peace." Which I thought is a really very nice thing for Sienkiewicz to say.
You know, Paul Levitz, I'm not going to read his. It's fairly lengthy. It's very nice. But he really points out that the Batman that most people know, Tim Burton's Batman, Christopher Nolan's Batman, I mean, that really came from a lot of what Denny put together. So, if you like Batman, which pretty much everyone does, you have Denny O'Neill to thank for that for the most part.
Ryan mentioned his writing on Justice League, and I mean, for considering how briefly Denny was on the book, he made a lot of changes. And just like about the year and a half that he wrote the book, he got rid of Wonder Woman. That was part of her depowering. He got rid of Martian Manhunter. He added Black Canary. Completely forgot that Aquaman was a member of the team. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that he really did. It was pretty amazing. I'm not still fully over that, by the way, but it's okay.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start to transition into talking about some of these stories? But before that, we do that, we should probably take a second to thank our sponsor. Folks, this episode of FW Presents is sponsored in part by the Patreon support, which we really appreciate. As you guys know, running a network of this size with so many shows takes a lot of funding for online support and, and hosting and all that. And you guys have been fantastic contributors to that. We really, really appreciate it. So if you want to support us, the best way to do that is through our Patreon, and that's at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. And as you go out there, you can find all the different benefits you can get for being a supporter, besides Rob's eternal love. And he'll put your name, actually, in his pillowcase when he goes to sleep at night. But at certain sponsorship tiers, you'll also get thanked on shows of your choice. For example, David Ace Gutierrez and Gord Holden, thank you very much for your support. So, folks, that's patreon.com/FW Podcasts. So, Rob, do you want to tell us – do you want to go first on your story?
Yeah, let me go first. As I mentioned, if you look up Denny O'Neil and Mike's Amazing World, you'll see all the different stories the guy wrote. And, I mean, he started out writing – like Patsy Walker stories and Millie the Model stories intertwined with like Doctor Strange, which is like, that's really cool. And then he wrote stuff for Charlton. He wrote Rawhide Kid. So there's a lot of, I wanted to pick something obscure, just because I think it's sort of fun to go through finding, you know, weird stuff that, I mean, everyone knows some of the more famous stories that he's written, but I thought it'd be fun to look something weird. And then I found, this story, which is called The Soft, Sweet Lips of Hell, from from Vampirella number 10, which was on sale December 17th, 1970. It was written by Denny and drawn by Neil Adams, which was super cool. I don't think – I mean, I'm a big fan of the Warren comics. I have a lot of the magazines, but I don't think I'd ever read this story before, and it was so cool to see a team that I associate so heavily with DC Comics in a Warren magazine. It's kind of like when you find – like you think you've heard all the work of like your favorite band, and then they're like, oh, yeah, they were also on this one compilation record. You're like, wait, what? You know, like this is a whole other thing. So I picked this story. It's only 10 pages long. The synopsis is such, it's very brief. A succubus, good way to start, a succubus falls in love with a boxer who is marked for a mob hit after he refuses to throw a fight. Every previous time the creature has kissed a man, she has drained the life force from him. When the boxer is shot dead by the mob and the succubus has drained the mobsters, she kisses the body of her lover and transfers every bit of her life force into him, sacrificing herself in order to bring him back to life. Okay. I'm not going to pretend this is a particularly great story because it is Denny O'Neil smashing together two very incompatible genres, because you've got this boxing story, which is something like out of a 1950s noir film, and then you've got this succubus story going on because it's a, you know, it's a horror magazine. It's Vampirella. Nevertheless, there's a joy to how goofy it is and how the Denny just doesn't let – the inherent craziness of the story slow him down. And of course, in my mind, there was no better artist for bringing Denny stories to life than Neil Adams. Neil Adams makes this girl, the succubus, about as gorgeous as you can possibly imagine.
Man.
I mean, it is stunning. Jeez. My God.
I'll say it for you. She's smoking hot.
It's unbelievable. I mean, she is a succubus. That's the way that's going to work. But I mean, it's just so fantastic. And I mean, I love, there's this point where after these mobsters come and they shoot her boyfriend, she goes into another room basically and kills them off one by one. She's like, why don't you go in here with me? And the guy's like, well, sure, I won't be a minute, guys. And she hears, like, you know, she kills one of them. And then she pops her head out of the door and she's like, want to join the party, fellas? And the guys are like, yeah, sure, why not? They're like, you idiots, don't go in there. It's a really fun story. It's completely crazy because, like I said, it mixes two genres that have no business being together. But I thought it was so fun. And again, I just love the novelty of seeing Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams do something that DC would have never let them do in one of their kind of boring horror comics at the time. They just would not have been able to. I mean, I think this girl's actually too sexy for a DC comic in 1970. Just would not have been able to get away with it. So I really enjoyed the story, and it was fun. You guys talked about like a street level persona that Denny brought to his stories. all the boxing stuff is very street level. I mean, you could imagine this guy being the kind of guy that like maybe fought Matt Murdock's dad at some point. And
it does feel very Battle and Jack Murdock story.
Absolutely. And yet again, you've got this horror element. So I really enjoyed it. It was super, super fun.
I noticed that it said it was inked by, I guess, Neil Adams and Steve Englehart. Talk about a Batman trifecta on this thing. Wow.
I didn't know that Steve Englehart did art at any point. So that part just confused me entirely. I always thought of him as a writer, but maybe he did some art stuff in the beginning of his career. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think there was like guys like him and Len Wein and Marv Wolfman were all trying to get into comics as artists, and they figured out they were better writers than artists, I guess.
No pressure, just I'm going to ink Neil Adams. No pressure
right
there. What, was Will Eisner busy? I mean, good Lord, that's crazy. But
didn't Denny do a Who's Who entry? Actually, speaking of art, didn't he draw?
He did. I think yes, he did. And someone else inked it.
Yeah.
But I think it was like Perez inked it, because that way you could, you know, bring in the ringer to make it really work
right
together. But yeah, this is for 10 pages, just so much crazy stuff happens. And it was, again, I enjoyed it. And from what I could see, it didn't seem like that Denny did much else for Warren, which is too bad, because I love Warren, and this was really a bliss. Like, it seems like a little, by the fact that it's so unique in his biography, I almost wonder if it wasn't something that they pitched to DC, and DC was like, nah, we're not going to do this, and so we just sold it to Warren or something.
I think the most disturbing thing in that whole issue is the old creepy old man that invites the succubus into his apartment to look at his new Sears Roebuck catalog.
That was just a weird, yeah. I was like, what the hell? Yeah.
So you talk about the diversity of what he did. It's interesting. I'm looking at all the picks of what we've got here, and not one of us picked a Batman story, which is sort of weird, given that we're doing a Denny O'Neill tribute. But I think what we're going to do is we're going to let Ryan go, and then I'll go. And I think, Chris, I'm going to save you for the end, because yours is probably one of the more sort of iconic Denny sort of stories, I think. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's got a little bit to say about modern times as well. So
I think that's very fair. All right, Mr. Daly, why don't we tell us your picks, sir?
Yeah, and I mean, I thought about bringing a Batman story. In fact, I was just telling Rob beforehand, because he lent me this black and white reprint, and I just read a great Denny O'Neill Batman story called If Justice Be Served. It's an 8-page backup with Michael Golden art. But ultimately, I was like, you know what, let's save that for Nightcast, the show that I actually care about. sorry. and previewing the next episode of Nightcast that comes out, Chris and I will be spending more time talking about Denny, and we will be covering some of his stories. I also had a really hard time thinking of what to cover for this, what book to bring. And I was looking at some of the Marvel stuff that he was writing and editing in the 80s. And actually, I mean, Rob, you covered one of the Iron Man books that he did on Mountain Comics with Sean Ross.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And getting back to, like, we'll talk more about that. But, you know, Denny was responsible for taking Tony Stark out of the armor for a while and bringing in Tony's alcoholism. He didn't introduce that element, but he gave that element actual consequences that affected Tony for 2 or 3 years. And in the meantime, he put Jim Rhodes in the Iron Man armor for a long time, and that was a big deal for a while. And while he was writing that, he was also editing Daredevil at the same time he was editing Moon Knight, at the same time he was editing Power Man and Iron Fist and Spectacular Spider-Man. And I was looking at Joe Duffy was writing Power Man and Iron Fist for a while.
Yes.
And Denny was editing that, and then she left. And maybe it was an abrupt departure, because she left and he took over writing the book for five issues. And then somebody replaced him. I don't remember who. But just within those 5 issues, you've got great stories that deal with all of the issues that he talks about. Race, like the characterization of these two guys. I mean, he if those were your first issues, you knew everything you needed to know about Luke Cage and Danny Rand. And they were great books. But I wanted to pick a book that was something different that nobody had talked about and that I hadn't even read yet. And I actually thought about his run on The Shadow. And I thought I had some of the original Shadow books from the 70s. I thought I got some, and I can't find them. So maybe I made that up. But I went to Comixology, and on Comixology Unlimited, I got The Shadow 1941, which was a Marvel, actually graphic novel, that reunited the original team from the DC Shadow books, which was Denny O'Neill writing and Michael Kaluta on art. And this was like one of Michael Kaluta's first thing was the 70s Shadow run. And they got back together for this graphic novel. It's like a 66-page, you know, Marvel graphic novel. And it's set in 1941. It's the subtitle is Hitler's Astrologer. And it's basically about this secretive faction within the Third Reich is trying to get Hitler to, you know, abandon the war on the Western Front that will draw Russia in the conflict. And they really want him to go full attack on London. And the Shadow has this premonition that if Hitler attacks London at this certain stage of the game, he'll wipe out all of Europe and the Nazis will be unconquerable. So they have to do this plot involving these astrologers and Hitler's fascination with the occult and his belief in this stuff. They have to manipulate this in such a way that Hitler will actually attack Russia instead, which will bring Russia onto the side of the Allies, and Germany will be fighting a war on two fronts, and that's what eventually causes them to lose the war. So there's all this stuff. So Denny was going into the history of this, and I found out later after the fact that Denny wrote the script, and then when Kaluta got it, he actually rewrote certain elements of it, especially at the end. And the very end of the book is a little bit, I don't want to call it ambiguous, but kind of, it doesn't feel like it has an ending. It just sort of stops. It's kind of a weird, but it's still a really, really fun story. And you get Denny's voice and his feel for this period, this pulp. He understands the Shadow, and the dialogue in this is just, it's great. It's just oozing with that kind of like that purple prose and stuff like that. And in terms of the art, I mean, when you think of the artist that can really bring the Golden Age to life and that World War II era, you feel the dirt, the grime, the sea air coming off of Coney Island. He's just really, really good. And I put him up there with the greats that can capture that period, like a Jerry Ordway, like Paul Smith from that Golden Age miniseries. It's a great, fun story. And Denny O'Neill, he brings this joy and this sense of mood and pulp sort of gristle to the dialogue and the characters. And it's a story about, you know, smashing Nazis and manipulating Hitler into making a mistake that will cost him his life. So that's always a joy to read.
Awesome. Well, I'll go ahead and cover mine. I picked Daredevil number 215, which is interesting. It's sort of sandwiched in between Frank Miller's runs. Frank Miller had two sort of seminal runs on Daredevil, which was the initial run where he became a writer and kind of became who everyone knows Frank Miller as now. And then when he came back for Born Again, and sort of like what happened in Ryan's example of Power Man and Iron Fist, when Frank left the book, Denny had to find a writer, and he wasn't sure anyone could really handle it. So he actually wrote Daredevil for a while himself.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
No, you may not.
All right.
Go ahead. I'll allow it.
Well, Rob, do you know who wanted to take over for Frank Miller but didn't get a chance?
He was going to be Alan Brenner. Alan Brenner did write an issue.
Brenner wrote the first issue after Frank Miller and said he would have done more after that, but yep. O'Neill wanted it.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, very. A lot of people were intimidated to follow Frank Miller, and Alan Brenner was like, I'm not intimidated, I'll do it.
Well, in this case, and this isn't necessarily a standout issue, but like people don't talk about it a lot, but when you read it, I think you'll get there with me. It's written by Denny, and art's by David Mazzucchelli. So you already know the art's great. But when David Mazzucchelli, back in these days, was doing his work and inked by someone else, his work was fine, but it wasn't David Mazzucchelli. And this was the first issue where Denny says that he, in an interview, that he realized what they had on their hands. This is the first issue they found out they had that David Mazzucchelli was going to be a star. And it's because they let him ink it himself. And there's a whole dream sequence here. I'll review the story, I guess, and then I'll back into this. All right. So the issue features an unexpected team-up between Daredevil and the Two-Gunned Kid. It's pretty strange. But their adventures take place 100 years apart. So in this extended black and white sequence, and this is what really made Mazzucchelli shine, in this extended black and white sequence, it takes place in 1885, and the Two-Gunned Kid rescues a young Apache Indian from a group of violent white bandits. And the Two-Gunned Kid learns that the bandits were after a map that will lead them to a land deed, which was authorized by the United States president. And this land deed will grant the Apaches the rights to this piece of land. Well, between his actions as Two Gun Kid and his alter ego as the lawyer Matt Hawk, he's unable to locate the deed. So the leader of the White Bandits, this man whose last name is Kino, he gets to keep the land that rightfully belongs to the Apache Indians. Well, fast forward 100 years, and Matt Murdock wakes up from a dream. He has just dreamt that entire incident. And when Matt goes into his office, he finds Foggy, who has set them up with his new client, a white man named Kino, who needs help defending his rights to this land, which the modern Apaches are claiming. So Matt travels to Arizona to investigate the thing. He winds up helping out the Apaches instead of his client. And Daredevil and a grandson of the original young Apache from the Two Gun Kid story, they wind up in a situation that almost directly parallels what the Two Gun Kid went through. And in the end, Daredevil finds the deed and the land gets returned to the Native Americans. So here you've got another story where Denny is talking about racism, where he's talking about people people using the law to keep a race down. It's when you step back from the goofy comics of this stuff, it's pretty interesting. And it's maybe it's a little heavy-handed in that, or maybe it's not, very nuanced. But, I mean, come on. This is, 1984. And for a 12-year-old kid who reads this comic, it's going to resonate with them. It's going to go, hey, wait a minute. That's not right. You can't treat other people that way just because of their background or their heritage. And I think it was great that he stood up for this. And I really enjoyed it. And have anybody seen the pages from this thing before by chance?
Not until you sent it to me. Boy, it looks amazing.
Isn't it? It is stinking gorgeous. And we talked earlier about Denny finding talent. I mean, he would have brought Mazzucchelli on the book as the editor, right? And he brought Frank Miller on that book. And think about that. The DNA in that, they did Born Again. They did, Batman Year One. I mean, there's so much here that leads to other stuff. So I absolutely love this story. What I originally was going to pick was a different Daredevil issue, because the very first Denny O'Neil comic that I know I ever read was an issue of Daredevil. It was issue 223. It was a Secret Wars 2 crossover. And the problem is it's got Jim Shooter's stink all over it. So that's why I chose not to cover that issue, even though it's a good one. It's about Matt getting his sight back and finding out what that means to him. But this one, I'm really glad I picked this one. I also want to give a plug, by the way, for a book Denny wrote. If you've ever thought about writing comic books, there's a fantastic book called DC Comics Guide to Writing Comics, written by Denny O'Neil. I went through a short phase where I thought I was going to write comic books. Thankfully, that didn't happen. I went into podcasting and said, you're lost, folks. I learned more from this little tiny skinny book about how comic books are read and A plots and B plots and C plots and all this stuff than anything else. And while I didn't ever get to apply that to comics, I certainly applied it to role-playing games for superheroes, and it's been invaluable. So it's a great book. Highly recommend it. Anyway, by the way, that Daredevil issue, it's available on Marvel Unlimited if you're a member, so check it out. All right, Mr. Franklin, why don't you bring us home with your pick?
Okay, I picked this story because it features the debut of the character of John Stewart, the Green Lantern, who is featured on Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, which Cindy and I cover on our JLU cast. I know this story, but rereading it, I'm like, oh, wow, we really should talk about this story right now. Beware My Power from Green Lantern / Green Arrow number 87, December, January 1971, was, of course, written by Denny O'Neil, illustrated by Neil Adams and Dick Giordano, and edited by Julia Schwartz. Green Lantern Hal Jordan responds to a massive earthquake in Southern California, and he finds that his replacement, substitute Green Lantern, Guy Gardner, is injured during this. This may be one of the first times he gets brain damage. I'm not sure.
A nice guy, too.
He is such a nice guy in this. When he's trying to save one of his students, he's such a sweet, sweetheart here. But he's injured, and he's going to be unavailable as a substitute Green Lantern for 6 months. So, of course, one of the Guardians appears before Hal and says, you got to go find another person to replace him. And we've got a prospect. So they go to this urban ghetto, as Denny describes it, and they find John Stewart taking up for some fellow black men who are being harassed by policemen for playing dominoes on the sidewalk without a permit and blocking foot traffic. So John calls BS on both accounts, and then when the cop asks if he wants trouble, he responds, I don't want it, but I'm not going to run from it either. So the cop complains to his partner that they got no respect, but his partner points out smartly that respect has to be earned, which I thought was a nice touch. Of course, Hal is flabbergasted that the Guardians are even interested in this guy, not because of any bigotry on his part, because he just sees that John's got this huge chip on his shoulder, according to Hal. But it's kind of neat because O'Neill skips, like, the introduction between these characters, and we pick up with Hal basically giving his final bit of his sales pitch to John in this this ice cream parlor, his candy shop. And he says, there's not a lot of work for a black architect, so yeah, I'll try your superhero gig. And he's got this, it's really cute because Neil Adams draws him with this frothy milkshake mustache as he's smiling at Hal. So, already you like this guy, right? So Hal shows him how to charge his power battery, recites the oath, and he gives him his costume and his mask, but he immediately throws the mask aside and he says, this black man lets it all hang out. I've got nothing to hide. So they train for hours in the sky, and Hal comments that, he's really mastered his ring really quick. And John points out, hey, it's easier than navigating through all the muggers I got to pass through to get home in the dark at night. So they're flying over this airport, and they spot a crowd rushing to meet a presidential hopeful named Senator Jeremiah Clutcher. His plane just arrived. And unfortunately, there are people rushing to the plane, but they're rushing right in front of this oncoming oil tanker. So Hal uses his power ring to create a cage and push the crowd away. And John uses his power ring to clamp on to the tanker part of the truck. And it just so happens that it squirts oil all over the senator. The senator is infuriated, and so is Hal, because he believes that John has embarrassed the senator on purpose because he is a known racist. And John angrily admits he did, since the senator is known as a racist and he plans on climbing to the White House on the backs of my people. Hal tells John no one appointed him judge, but he does appoint him as the senator's personal guard. If anything happens to the senator under their watch, then John's out of the Corps. It's over. So later the senator's holding a rally at a nearby stadium, and he tries to paper over his blatant racism with phrases like, understand, I've got nothing against the darkies. Yeah, that's a good job. Yeah. Which makes both John and Hal, who are watching this from above, sick. Hal chalks it up to the price we pay for free speech, but suddenly a black gunman enters the stage and fires at the senator, proclaiming, you'll die for your lies. Hal tells John to help him chase the shooter, but John informs him he's leaving. An angry Hal catches up to the would-be assassin, and he begins to berate him for disobeying his orders. An equally angry John tells Hal to go get the pistol, use to shoot Clutcher, and then he'll teach the teacher a thing or two. John explains he saw both the black gunman and the white machine gunner with Clutcher at the airport. The black man's pistol was filled with blanks, keeping the senator safe, but potentially framing blacks for both the attempted assassination of a senator and the actual murder of a policeman outside, stirring public opinion to Clutcher's way of thinking, guaranteeing him a seat in the White House and a race war in the United States. Hal tells Clutcher he's beyond contempt, but he's certain his fellow congressman will put him where he belongs. Yeah, if only. Hal tells John, I'll admit, John, your style turned me off. I was more than ready to stick the blame on you. And John responds, no sweat, pal, only style isn't important any more than color. So this comic doesn't feel timely at all, does it?
Man.
Go ahead, Rob.
Sorry. I was going to say, it's amazing how much O'Neill, how much story he was able to cram into just 13 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. And it's grounded in problems that the country was facing then, and it's definitely facing now. But there's still guys flying around with magic power rings. There's still little blue aliens. And somehow Denny mixes it together and makes it all work. There's not a lot of people that can pull that off. And that's what he brought the comic. He ground the fantasy world in with this reality. And I know Neil Adams has said, it was kind of his idea to, when they were talking about, we need another replacement Green Lantern. He said, well, why wouldn't you pick a black guy? You know, it's like, it just makes sense to Julius Schwartz. And I think, supposedly when the script came in, John's name was originally something like Lincoln Washington or Hannibal Lincoln. And he said, why don't you just name him something like John Stewart that's a little less, obvious, stereotypical or whatever. And so they made that change. Well, they both contributed. But, I think the story, you got to give the credit for the story to Denny because he made all these different elements work. And like you said, Shag, a young person reading this, and I've heard people say, you know, well, maybe the Hard Traveling Heroes, it's a bit heavy handed. Maybe it's a little too, you know, it's not subtle enough nowadays. But I don't know, man. Reading this now, I felt pretty good about reading this story right now.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, if there's any problem with it, you realize, okay, this is a story from 50 years ago, and it could have been written today. So has anything changed? I mean, I would hope that more comics that come out in the next couple of years sound and feel like this comic.
Well, a lot of this is a reaction, too, to what people were finding out that the government was doing, how they were trying to sow the seeds of racism and how they were trying to manipulate the black community. So, I mean, there's a lot of echoes in the story of that going out at the time. Absolutely. So it was timely then.
Mm. Also, what a massive contribution to the legend of DC Comics by Jon Stewart. I mean, like, it became like one of the biggest, I mean, might be one of Denny's single biggest creations is Jon Stewart, how big he became to the Green Lantern franchise. And I mean, good Lord, he was the character on JLU for Pete's sake.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've all said at one point or another, I mean, kids today, Jon Stewart's Green Lantern, not Hal Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to my kids, you know, that's Green Lantern. And you know, and to put characters like John, you know, on Justice League, I mean, my son grew up, there was no difference between Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, or John. They were all equal stature, and it didn't matter what color they were. And I mean, that's something Denny brought to comics. Yes, Marvel had beat DC, much stodgier DC, by, you know, Gabriel Jones and T'Challa, Black Panther, of course, and then the Falcon. But, you know, DC had Mal Duncan and the Teen Titans. But, you know, John was their first super-powered black character, as far as I know. I think he was.
And I don't think Mal Duncan was ever on a cover of Teen Titans. I think Jon Stewart was the first black character to be on the cover, or at least the first superhero to be on the cover of a DC comic.
Yeah, yeah, and he's all angry holding Hal, who's, you know, beat down on that cover. It's like, yeah, it's great.
and Denny also, he didn't create Black Lightning, but after the series ended, and or maybe he wrote the last story or something after Tony Isabella left, but he would do more with Black Lightning in like World's Finest backup strips and stuff like that. He created Ben Turner in the Richard Dragon comic, which eventually became Bronze Tiger, who has, you know, been in some of their TV shows and things like that. Might be in the Suicide Squad sequel. I don't even know. But I was saying over at Marvel, I mean, he didn't create Jim Rhodes, but he made him a character of note and put him in the armor. And Jim Rhodes was the Iron Man during Secret Wars and during the West Coast Avengers when that was formed. I mean, that was he made that character substantive.
Yeah, I mean, if Denny hadn't put him in the armor then, you wouldn't have John Cheadle playing War Machine in the movies now,
right,
probably.
Right, exactly. Well, his contributions are certainly massive. And standing up, as I think, Ryan, you call it, an original or old school social justice warrior, is that right?
If not the first, yeah.
Yeah. Certainly in the mainstream comics, he was definitely a champion for that, and somebody that we could use today, certainly.
There is a couple things, just brief things I want to mention before we wrap up, and just some other credits that I want to mention. Of course, he wrote the Superman versus Muhammad Ali Treasury Edition, which is one of the great Treasury Editions of all time, drawn by Neil Adams, which we covered over on Treasury Cast. He wrote the second issue of the Further Adventures of Indiana Jones with John Byrne, and that is the part two of a two-parter. I absolutely will die on this hill. That story should have been an Indiana Jones movie. It is such a good story. That story is a classic. It absolutely should have been. I think it probably should have been the second movie. They should have not even bothered with the Temple of Doom nonsense. They've just done this story. And then not related to a specific story he wrote, but something specific to Denny. He had one of the great pseudonyms of all time, Sergius O'Shaughnessy. You know, nowadays modern comics fans can't relate to the idea that you couldn't work for one company if you worked for the other. That just seems crazy. But back then, you kind of really couldn't get away with it. So Gene Colan Adam Austin? Was his name, right? Yep. Okay. Adam Austin is a believable name. You know, when you read that, you're like, I don't know who this guy is. He seems to draw a lot like Gene Colan. But okay. But even as a child, and I was not a bright child, even as a child, I knew Sergius O'Shaughnessy was a bullshit name. I'm like, come on, that it's not. That, I didn't know who it was, but I knew that there was no writer named Sergius O'Shaughnessy. So I just love the cleverness of coming up with such a nonsense pseudonym as that. I think that's good on you, Denny. That's a great name.
Well, I don't know any better way to end it than that, Rob.
Our tribute to Sergius O'Shaughnessy.
So, folks, go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com. Go to the FW Presents page and share some of your thoughts on Denny O'Neill, maybe some of your favorite stories that he wrote or edited, or his contributions to comic books in general, or just any of your feelings at all. We would love to hear those. Or you can hit us up on social media. It's FW Podcast on Twitter and Firewater Podcast on Facebook. Guys, thanks so much for being here today and sharing some of your thoughts and some of your strong feelings and favorite moments from Denny's career. So, everybody, why don't you say goodbye to the groups. Rob, what do you got to say?
I have one last thing that I will say before we sign off is that, of course, here at the Fire and Water Podcast Network, we have a reputation for making things happen. You know, we seem to do things. We seem to talk about things on shows, and then they happen. You know, for different things. Oh, this trade paperback's now being collected, or this stuff's on Comixology, or whatever. I'm going to say, I think the network needs to use its power in this case to make something not happen, and in that case, is no more comic pros can die. That's what we're putting out there, okay? Because we've gotten together to talk about the great Martin Pascal. Now we've gotten together to talk about Denny O'Neill. There's too many great writers out there. You all need to stay safe and healthy. So I'm going to use our positive mental fire and water energy to keep everybody safe and healthy so we can do tribute shows to them and they can be around to enjoy them.
Yes, preemptively, we will tell you there's at least one tribute show in the works right now. Maybe even recorded. I'm not telling you.
I think it'll be out before this one.
Oops, or you've already heard it at home, but created it still with us. So there we go. Chris, why don't you give us your closing thoughts?
Well, I just want to, you know, I think we've sang Denny's praises, but we can't sing them enough. And just want to say, tell everybody, just go find a Denny O'Neill story and read it. I mean, he's just one of the best. I mean, you know, the name legend, the word legend gets thrown around a lot, even in the comic industry, but literally, Denny O'Neill is one of the top writers that ever wrote comics, bar none, and you can't go wrong with a Denny O'Neill story. So go read a Denny O'Neill story, and, you know, he'll entertain you, and he'll make you think. He'll always stop and make you think, and that's a good thing to do.
Speaking of someone that doesn't think often enough, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, as Chris alluded to, we are not going to stop talking about Denny O'Neill because we've just started getting into some of his greatness that when he was actually writing Batman, and we're going to be doing more of that on Nightcast future episodes. One book that Denny O'Neill is really associated with that none of us talked about is The Question. That's did with Dennis Cohn. And I've never read that series. I have heard countless great things about the series, and I like the team because I've Denny O'Neill and Dennis Cowan illustrated some of his Power Man and Iron Man stories. So I like them together, and I would really like to see their work on The Question. But if any of our listeners wanted to do a podcast on that subject, save me the work of actually reading it, and I'll just listen along to your fine discussions. You know, if somebody wants to take a bite out of that, you know, I would happily subscribe to that show. You know. So go to it.
Perfect. And I will just close by saying, echoing what you guys said, find a Denny comic to read or find one of the books he edited and realize that some of the amazing ideas that are happening, some of the really dynamic changes that happen in those books, Denny had a hand in, but he didn't force it down their throats. He just guided and helped them find their own vision. So amazing, amazing guy. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you guys in the near future. Bye.
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 This is what Neil Adams and I did. We went back to May of 1939 to what Bill Finger and Bob Kane did. And we simply did that character, adding what people learned in the ensuing 25 years about telling comic book stories. And I believe that until I got the job as Batman editor and actually went back and read that stuff. So I think there's something in Aristotle's Poetics about an idea that is implicit in a drama. Our Batman was implicit, and I don't know that we would have come up with it if that hadn't been true, but it was, for the time, a fairly radical departure.